This is a Hipsters of the Coast podcast. This Doom Travelers podcast is brought to you by Hipsters of the Coast, your destination for magic news, strategy, and entertainment. And by Casthaven, where you can build your magic collection like a pro. Visit casthaven.com for more information.
All right, so welcome to yet another episode of Doom Travelers, the magic podcast. We've been away for a couple weeks. Dave McCoy, my regular co-host, was on vacation, and then I took vacation the week after him. But we're back now, still joined by special guest Brendan McNamara. Matt Jones is still away in Paris. His show opened successfully this past week to great fanfare. He's very excited. He'll be back with us in a couple weeks. But we're happy to have Brendan here. And as always, I'm your host, Rich Stein. So this week we're going to talk about the Pro Tour. Pro Tour was a couple weeks ago now, but we think there's still plenty of stories there to talk about. So Dave, what was the big takeaway for you from the Pro Tour?
I would say Ojutai and Silumgar. It turns out when you release a set called Dragons of Darkir, the dragons mean business.
Yeah, dragons were everywhere. This is the Pro Tour for dragons. Ironically, the Dragon Master Brian Kibler didn't do so well at the Pro Tour, but it is what it is.
Because he didn't play any dragons.
He didn't. I know, huge mistake. So Brendan, what about you? What was your big takeaway from Pro Tour?
I really enjoyed watching Shota Yasuoka play. I think he's just an amazing Magic player to watch, and like he plays these control decks and just sits there and plays so fast and knows exactly what's going on, and it's just I think he epitomizes like what you want out of a good Magic player and being able to watch him on coverage, as opposed to some other situations that were on coverage or off coverage where people play sloppy or there were some cheating and disqualifications and stuff.
So right.
I was gonna make it to the finals, and also Adrian Sullivan, who's another longtime control player. And
It's a sign.
Control is good in this metagame when two of the top control players show up and their own design deck, not even like necessarily the best Asper Dragons deck the Channel Fireball had, which also did really well. And Paulo Vita Demidorosa came in like top 16. You know, it's the first time he's done well in the Pro Tour in a while, I feel like.
It's true. I think, you know, the metagame is as good a place to start talking as any. And I think the return of control in a big way is going to be it's going to be a serious story coming up in this metagame for the next few months in Standard. Control's kind of been absent for a while, wouldn't you guys say?
Well, since Sphinx's Revelation, I guess.
Yeah, so I mean, Sphinx's Revelation was RTR, right?
Yeah.
And RTR rotated out when Khanzatark here hit the floor.
Yeah, about 6 months ago.
Yeah, but even when Sphinx's Revelation was around, I always thought of it as of that control deck, not really as an oppressive deck in the format the way control decks used to be. Right, it seemed kind of like a fair control deck. I guess resolving Sphinx's Revelation was the real catch on that in those decks. But do you think the new control decks, Brendan, are going to be a dominant force in Standard?
I think they are. The red deck is really strong, and it can give the control decks a run for their money. But I've been hearing that, you know, the control decks don't have, like, it isn't a horrible matchup. The blue-black decks that Shota and Adrian were playing at the Pro Tour that lost to Martin Deng's Atarka red deck were not, like, fully tuned to deal with it. And, you know, they weren't the best. But even then, they have good cards and, you know, it just depends on the draw. And that's the only deck I've seen that really give control difficulties are the really fast red decks and maybe some of the whip decks that have a lot of recursion, like Den Protector and Deathmist Raptor are pretty good against them. Those, like, I've messed around with Blue Black a little bit over the last week online, and like I was able to beat a whip deck, but it took a lot of work. So that, though, those decks might see a little more play.
Right. So I mean, obviously the big card there is Silumgar, right? And so Blue Black is at the core of this control deck, as opposed to Blue White, which was really the core of the Sphinx's Revelation decks, with Blue White for that, and also Supreme Verdict, of course, was a big part of that. But with Blue Black being the new core, do you think? I think there's been some Esper. You know, the Esper decks are also kind of popular. Do you think it's going to be a two or three color control that kind of rules the day, Dave?
Well, it seems like Esper has definitely won out in the short term, based on GP Krakow that happened this last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Five, I believe, of the top eight decks ended up being Esper Dragons. Paulo Vitor reprised the deck and managed to top four with it. Alexander Hain picked it up and ended up winning the GP with it. And so five of those decks decided to splash white for Ojutai as another threat on top of Dragonlord Silumgar.
Because you can't really have enough crazy legendary dragons.
No,
can you?
And honestly, what allows them to make that splash in part is the Haven of the
the Dragonlord.
Yeah, Haven of the Spirit Dragon. Thanks. And what that allows you to do is, one, it allows you to make white for Ojutai, but it also lets you recur your Ojutai or your Silumgar or even your Ugin, which all of these decks also play. Six of these top eight decks play Ugin, and six of the top eight decks play Ojutai, and six of the top eight decks play Silumgar. It's insane. These dragons are everywhere.
It turns out that Ojutai is, like, because it has five power, you know, it's sort of like Prognostic Sphinx, I think, was that one that scryed when it attacked and had Hexproof. You know, and that was pretty good, but it only had three power, so it took a long time to kill. But Ojutai hits for five. You know, you just play it, and you have enough, like, counter spells to protect it for three or four turns, and you're just going to win the game. And so they're basically just playing the blue-black deck and then putting in Ojutai because it's so good. And with Haven of the Spirit Dragon, you don't have to play that many other white sources. You know, Scrylands are always welcome in these decks.
Right. So the environment seems pretty set up for dragons to succeed.
Yeah, and I think one other card that's really making the deck work is Silumgar Scorn. Just, it's almost counterspell, you know?
Right.
And just being able to have a strong two mana counterspell. We haven't had one that can counter anything since Mana League.
Yeah, the point that the European coverage team made during the top eight today, I thought it was a very salient point. They said that a lot of the time Silumgar Scorn is just going to be a force spike,
right.
But if you play around that force spike, you just give your opponent a little more time to make it into counterspell, and so really it's not a good strategy to try and play around the force spike and just waste your turn. You kind of, in the control mirrors, you have to just jam the spell and
use it.
Yeah, otherwise you just give them time to draw one of their, six or seven dragons and turn it into actual counter spell.
Yeah. That is a crazy kind of turn of events. I think it's exciting to see that Wizards has really been able to push the dragons, not just to be, you know, the limited bombs we all knew they would be, but also to be constructed playable. And we've talked a lot about Ojutai and Silumgar, and I don't want to take anything away from Atarka, right? Who showed up in force at the Pro Tour as well, right?
Yeah, Atarka is a really strong card. There are a lot of people, you know, playing red-green decks, or even, like, I think, like, Ari Lox's team splashed it in their Abzan deck. You know, it's just an incredible card.
Right.
The only problem it has right now is it isn't as good against control because they don't have any creatures that can kill, and then they just kill it. So, Or they counter right. it for 7 mana. So I think it's getting less play than it would. And if control decks stop being so dominant, or people find other ways to reduce their amount in the metagame, then Atarka is really strong.
Yeah. Do you think Atarka fits better in the aggressive red focus decks, the burn decks and the beatdown decks, or do you think it fits like Lox's team in more of a mid-rangey kind of build?
Yeah, well, I mean, it costs 7 mana, and so it's hard to really play it in the burn decks, even though, like, maybe the burn decks adapt and have a sideboard with, like, Outpost, Siege, and Atarka and stuff that they can convert into having a longer game, you know, try Round and Sorrow and Bile Blight, I guess, are the main things that could slow them down. But I think, like, there's just so many good, cheap red cards, all these dragons and stuff. And Atarka's command is so good in an aggressive deck that you feel like you don't need Atarka.
Right. Yeah, the command is definitely... I think everyone kind of saw that one coming when they spoiled Atarka's command. It's very versatile. It's very powerful. So the metagame's shaping up to kind of be control versus aggro. Do you think this is the end of Siege Rhino's Reign of Terror? Dave?
Not at all. I think Siege Rhino is suffering a little from being 6 months old as opposed to the new thing. I think Siege Rhino is too much value to be pushed out of the metagame so easily. Unfortunately, it suffers a little bit from the same problem Atarka has versus these control decks. There are just a lot of good 2-mana answers to it.
Right.
But since Siege Rhino only costs 4 as opposed to 7, it has a much higher chance, I think, of making it back. And plus, the white and the black spells in this metagame are still very strong.
Yeah.
You know, these blue-black decks are built on the strength of the black removal that they contain.
Right.
Without that black removal, the blue-black decks wouldn't be able to one-for-one their opponent quite as well. And with those black spells and with the powerful white spells, you still have the draw to junk decks or Obzon decks.
Yeah. Yeah, so it looks like we got a pretty solid rocks, paper, scissor format between the red aggro decks, which just won the Pro Tour, the control decks, which... As Dave said, put up a very strong result in GP Krakow this weekend. And then the mid-range Obzon decks, which probably are not going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine Den Protectoring your Siege Rhino back? That seems pretty sweet, just being able to constantly rebuy your Siege Rhinos and replay them.
Yeah.
I think Siege Rhino is just suffering from a lack of a clear... new home, but it's still extremely powerful.
Right. So you think maybe it's not an Abzan mid range deck anymore, but there's got to be a home for it. It's such a powerful card, right?
Yeah.
I think Abzan is definitely the other, like the third deck between like a blue black or Esper control on one end and red based aggro burn on the other, and a lot of people are going to keep playing Obzon, and there's just so many tools that you have.
Right.
Grimmas or something, or Wingmate Rock that are still out there that no one's playing at all. You know, maybe
their
cards. You know, Elspeth is still an incredible card. You know, Ajani and Sorin do a lot of work. There's so many removal, and like between Abzan Term and Read the Bones, they can keep up with control decks on card draw, at least to some extent. You know,
Heroes. Yeah, that makes sense.
Everything.
It definitely makes sense. So metagame Pro Tour, pretty good stuff. Finals of the Pro Tour, very exciting, right? The Deng Sullivan match. I thought it was. I caught the replay of it after I got home from vacation. Watched it a little bit. I've always been a big fan of Adrian Sullivan. I had not heard of Martin Deng, but. I thought the match was a really great Pro Tour Finals. And it was good to see Adrian have success finally after so many years. You guys enjoy that part of the coverage at least? We'll talk a little bit about the rest of the coverage in a moment, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought I watched, like, because the top eight came on at like 1 in the morning out here.
Yeah.
And so I just stayed up and watched the quarterfinals and then went to sleep. You know, just who wants to stay up and wait an hour or two for them to go to the semis?
Right.
You know, I watched the rest on the replay. And just the level of play across the board was very high. I mean, like Martin Deng, apparently he's like a longtime player, I think in Denmark, who was like an older player who had, you know, not played for a while and just started to come back and really
work. Right.
And like he played that red deck incredibly well. I think, you know, a lot of people think red decks are easy to play. All you have to do is count, you know, but that's not quite the case. And he made the deck look even stronger than it is because he just played very well. Adrian Sullivan played very well and was enjoyable to watch other than the fact that his cards are upside down.
Yeah. It was, you know, a lot of people on the Twitter were very upset about the way Adrian plays. You know, there were a lot of people who were like, oh, you know, you have to have uniformity. It doesn't look good. You know, you got to have this thing or it's just, you know, can't have this kind of coverage, right? Where they were unable to follow it, and people were yelling that the coverage team needs to do more. But really, it just seems like people needed something to complain about.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to reiterate what BMAX said. I think even though the mono red deck, well, I guess mono red splash green deck won the Pro Tour, I think the finals match was probably one of the most technically proficient finals we've seen in a long time. It was just so well played from both sides. Like you saw game one, Adrian Sullivan convinced Martin Deng just through in-game choices and physical posturing that he had Aether Spouts in hand. And so Martin Deng played that entire game around a card that was not in Adrian Sullivan's hand. And that was just like another level of the game that you don't often see get to see on camera. And then also, like, you saw Martin Deng play the red deck and after running out of gas in one of the games against Adrian Sullivan, he recognized that he had the way he was going to win was through leveraging his cheaper spells and trying to run Adrian Sullivan out of mana, out of the ability to answer him. So he built up a set of spells in his hand that were cheap enough for him to cast all at once, but were not. But Adrian Sullivan's answers were just slightly too expensive for him to answer all at once. So he had to recognize that he had to hold back answers that threats that he probably would have wanted to play out normally, so that he could force, so he could take advantage of the mana efficiency that his deck had.
Yeah, it's very impressive. It's one of the more difficult things in Magic is to be able to recognize what your best win condition is going to be and then what the plan is to get there. A lot of players have trouble getting to that point. And Deng clearly knew. He's like, you know, look, you could keep playing incremental spells, but none of them are going to win him the game, and that line of play isn't going to win him the game either. But if he could build up what he did, which you don't know if he could, right? He could just keep ripping lands off the top, and then he never gets there. But, you know, you got to know what your best line of play is, know your outs, and then play to that plan. And it was, like you said, very technically impressive.
I really enjoyed seeing Andre Strosky, who made his second top eight in like three Pro Tours at the age of like 19. Looks like he's going to be a real, like, the next leader of like Eastern European Magic, and incredibly well. And his match in the semifinals against Shoto was really, really good to watch. He was playing the green red dragons deck, Nissa and Xenagos end up being cards that you use a lot against the control decks. And, you know, he was able to take a game and make the other two games very interesting and just very tight play.
Yeah, I think this Pro Tour is a good example of that bears out Wizards' decision to show every single quarterfinals match instead of playing them all at once.
Right.
I know a lot of people were mad that they switched from best of five to best of three, but almost every single one, I'd say three out of the four quarterfinals, were very much worth that sacrifice, just because the players were so good, the matchups were excellent, and the play was top notch.
Yeah, I think so. I think so for sure. You know, the best of five matches at times could feel really unwieldy, also, and sometimes I miss them. Like, I think the matches, the Sullivan matches would have been great to go to a few more games, but ultimately, I think being able to watch all of the quarterfinals play out is worth that sacrifice every day. So that's definitely the highlights of the coverage, but there was also some lowlights to the coverage. Cheating, again, was prevalent at the Pro Tour. This is starting to, it's becoming a disturbing trend, but it's interesting in a sense, because cheating on the whole in Magic is very likely down from the, I guess, the glory days of cheating back in the 90s and even up to 10 years ago. But what's now happening is coverage, right? And now that all of the high-profile matches are on video and available for scrutiny, we're seeing cheating a lot more. So there were four high-profile cases of cheating at the Pro Tour. Patrick Chapin played two lands in one turn. Nobody caught it. A lot of people don't think it was intentional, but it happened. It was on camera. And it happened right before another incident, which we can talk about in a bit. Felipe Valdivia got board wiped. And as he was picking up his creatures, he picked up a scry land, which he then immediately used to trigger Narset, directly leading to a game win. He's publicly apologized for it, said he was not malicious, but the jury's still out on that one. Jeremy Dazani lied to a judge about game state in order to try to get a better result from an investigation. Jeremy Dazani, of course, was noted at was the World Championship, where he was scouting what cards players were buying from a local vendor. Yeah, the World Championship with Jeremy Dazani is from France, and the Worlds were being held in Nice. And last but not least, Stephen Speck, who rose to fame playing Amulet Bloom at the Grand Prix recently in Modern, was caught putting his opening seven cards up his sleeve, essentially, and presenting a deck with only 53 cards in it. To which Tom Martell cleverly tweeted that he was shocked that the player who had five turn one victories with Amulet Bloom combo at the Grand Prix was palming his opening seven. Not the finest moment for the Pro Tour coverage, for sure, with respect to cheating. Do you guys think that cheating is becoming a bigger problem, Dave?
No. I think there are a couple issues going on with this. One is that the particular people involved have had recent success, like Stephen Speck being the biggest example. He lost in the finals at GP Vancouver with Amulet Bloom and could have won that tournament if he had known how to play the deck well, instead of palming his opening seven. And so I think that's part of why this example of cheating hit so hard. And that is on top of the previous public flaying of Jared Betcher, who also rose through the ranks and then was found to just have cheated his way there.
Right.
And then you combine that with the fact that Jeremy Dazani won was it Pro Tour Return to Ravnica?
Yeah.
No, it was Theros. It was Mono Blue he won.
Okay.
Pro Tour Theros. And now he hasn't necessarily cheated in terms of manipulating his deck or manipulating his opponent's deck, but
right.
has been caught twice now in 6 months having lied to Magic officials or judges, which,
yeah.
you know, and so I think there have always been, there's always been cheating on the Pro Tour. There are always examples of cheaters on the Pro Tour. But
yes.
I think the reason it hits so hard in this Pro Tour is there have been a lot of high profile cheaters, and two of the supposed cheaters in this Pro Tour happen to have a record of success recently. And that just hurts. Makes you question all of their achievements.
Yeah, no, that's a huge one. And definitely with Jared Betcher as well. You see us players rise quickly. And then, you know, you get feature matches because you've had this success. And then all of a sudden everyone sees what's going on behind the curtain, so to say. Brendan, how big of a role do you think the coverage plays in how we view cheating nowadays?
I think that it's just a lot more out in the open, and there's people talking about games. You know, it's showing live, and people are watching, and people are paid to comment on it, and then they're stored on, you know, archives for people to watch later. And there's more people, there's more eyes going on all of these matches, and so things are going to get caught. You know, it's kind of like how deck building used to. No one really knew how to build decks, and the people who had an edge really had an edge. And then now, so much information is out and available that it's just getting worked together, and people are refining decks and being able to bring the level of play up to a very high level across the board. And I think the same thing's happening with cheating, where it's just so much harder to actually get away with it.
Right.
I think there's always going to be people who are willing to cheat to get ahead at anything. I mean, go to graduate school for whatever,
right.
you know, business school or law school or something. There's always people who are pushing the boundaries and seeing what they can get away with. And it's going to come up in Magic, because Magic attracts people who are competitive and intelligent. And unfortunately, some of those people are cheaters. Fortunately, not a lot of them. And hopefully we will just get better at not only catching them, but just shaming them in public, of, you know, just making it be something that's just not acceptable.
If right.
You were just manipulating the rules. That's a smart thing to do, you know. That's,
but what is the best way to kind of cut off cheating, right? Because obviously, you know, we don't have any proof, but at this point it's difficult not to assume that Steven Speck was cheating at Grand Prix Vancouver. But you know, it seems to be a situation where people like him and people like Jared Betcher, where there's a lot of cheating going on at the lower levels, and we're just not catching it until it's on camera at the Pro Tour. Do you guys think that the current means of deterrent, which is suspensions and bannings from the DCI, do you think that's doing enough to prevent cheating at the lower levels, or do you think there's a better solution, Dave?
You know, I don't think there's any other real solution. You have to provide a standardized and consistent process for people to go through, and that requires bureaucracy and time, and it also requires people reporting it. And at lower levels, like your normal, your everyday SCG tournament, people aren't going to call a judge when your opponent makes a possibly innocent mistake, and then they're able to play cleanly the rest of the game through, and so you never suspect anything. But then if they make that same quote-unquote mistake the next round, they can play it off again. And that those patterns are only identified when judges get involved and start creating a record. But in general, Magic is a social game. Everybody wants to be the positive, enjoyable opponent. When they sit down to a game, they you have to talk to this person for the next hour. you don't want to, you know, antagonize them unnecessarily. And so I'm not sure there's a much better way. You're just not going to get people to call a judge for every innocent mistake. And that's just going to prevent catching these people at the lower levels. I think you're going to have to wait until the higher levels to find them. I'm just not sure there's a better way.
Yeah, I think it's really tough, too, because Magic is such a complex game, and you have to think about so many things. And, like, if you play a GP day one, and you play 9 rounds or 6 or 7 or 8 rounds, depending on your buys, you know, that's a lot of Magic. And, you know, I find myself making stupid mistakes. You know, sometimes you do forget if you play the land, especially if there's a judge call in the middle of a turn or something. But that's exactly the sort of situation that a cheater can exploit. And cheaters will do things like call judges in the middle of the turn after playing a land so that they can then play another one. And but like me personally, I know I've made mistakes. I mean, I even wrote about one before where I played the wrong card of the morph. But, you know,
that, right.
It didn't make any sense for it to be cheating there because I was just playing it to chump, to trade off on a block. And like, I just went and flipped it over and it was just like went white as a sheet when it wasn't a morph. But people who know where the natural things that happen where people make mistakes in Magic, because everyone does it. I mean, LSV drew an extra card going off with Glimpse of Nature. I think Sam Black or someone else. I mean, Chapin had this issue with a Johnny that we'll talk about. You know, there's lots and lots where you just you're either shortcutting or you think you did something or you just misses something because there's so much to think about that it's very hard to call a judge in all of those situations to make a record.
No, that's true. And, the Chapin incident, which we can definitely get into, is a great example of, you know, the rules being, you know, kind of written as they are for a reason. And sometimes it doesn't play out maybe the way that's fair or just or has the best integrity, but it's the way things have to be handled, so to say. So the Chapin incident, for those of you who don't know, Patrick activated the +1 ability on a Johnny, Mentor of Heroes. He looked at the top four of his deck, found that there was one creature and 3 lands, and you can clearly see this on camera, and then put the one creature, which was Tassigar, into his hand without revealing it to his opponent. His opponent rightfully called a judge over, or notified the table judge that what had happened, and the table judge gave Patrick a game loss. The rules involved, this is the correct call. Patrick appealed, and he tried to argue with the head judge, and this is where things kind of start to get a little hazy, because he argues with the head judge that the video replay will show that he didn't do anything wrong, and that the choice he made was, in fact, the legal choice. But the rules are very clear that video replay cannot be used for determining the results of a ruling. Patrick gets a game loss, and his Pro Tour kind of goes downhill from there, unfortunately. He was 5-0 at the time, and it kind of went downhill. So what was your how do you feel about how the whole situation was kind of handled, Dave?
I was one of the unfortunate people to watch it live, and that's what I get for waking up early. And it was super awkward because the call was correct. And if you've watched enough Magic or played enough Magic, you knew that the call was correct from the table judge, that a game loss was the appropriate punishment. And then the call to the head judge added about 10 minutes of on-camera awkward rules lawyering.
Yeah.
And I say rules lawyering, which has a negative connotation, but I don't mean to say that Chapin did anything wrong in terms of his interaction with the head judges. He made the cases that he is allowed and perfectly, like he should have made. He should have argued as hard as he possibly could. But the fact of the matter is it was a game loss, and it always should have been a game loss, but we should have never been a party to anything beyond the initial table judge call. It was an awkward 15 minutes of live, TV, And and honestly, like, Magic
is the problem,
never made
though.
Me...
But is the problem though that we got to see it, or is the problem the way in which it was presented? Because I think, and Brendan, I think you have some good opinions on this one too. But I think that there's a lot of value in seeing some of the judging, right? One of the things that I think is a problem at low-level Magic is a lot of new players have trouble crossing the line from casual Magic to competitive Magic. And one of the very important parts of crossing that line into competitive Magic is understanding that any time anything goes remotely wrong or in a way that you think you have a question or you think something just isn't right, you call a judge immediately. And for us, you know, for the three of us, we've been competitive Magic players for quite some time now. So I think none of us really have any qualms about calling a judge. But for a lot of new players, they feel that calling a judge in some way means that they're disrespecting their opponent. And that's certainly not the case. And I think there's a lot of value in showing people that it's okay to call a judge. It's okay to appeal to the head judge. Judges are not mean people. Your opponent shouldn't get offended if you call a judge. They're there to make things right. But I think, Dave, to your point, the way in which this was presented just reflects very poorly on almost everybody involved, except for Patrick Chapin and the judges, who I thought did a fine job. But Brendan, I'll let you respond to that, because I think you have a lot of opinions on this.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, like, the rule as it's set up, you know, we don't want people drawing extra cards. And there's just a very clear line that if a card touches the rest of your hand, you've drawn it. And if you weren't allowed to draw a card right then you're going to lose. Even if you're in the middle of comboing off and you're going to be able to draw infinite cards. Or even if, you know, in the situation with Chapin, it was very clear because his hand was setting down on the table. He picks up the four cards for a Johnny. He sees one that's a creature. He sets it down on the table, touching the rest of his hand. And then he goes to shuffle up or do whatever with the other four cards, put it on the bottom of his library. And so, like, in his mind, you know, it's very easy to say, oh, I'm just finishing the resolution of a Johnny, and then I could even just go and flip up that card. It's obvious which one it is. You know, my hand's on the table. It's the one that's to the left in that situation. And, you know, we could have a rules system that allows you to not give a game loss in that situation. There is room where that could make sense. And maybe there might actually be some level of discretion. I don't know the level at which judges have to be able to downgrade things. Having read Patrick Chapin's article, he seemed to think that there was some room there. I don't know if that's right or not. But.
Yeah, so the official rule, just so everyone's clear, is that the way that this works is that specific rule infraction gets upgraded and downgraded depending on whether or not your opponent can prove the legality of the selection you made. So in this case, Chapin's argument is that his opponent should know all the cards in his hand thanks to a cursor of Krufix that existed.
I think arguing it based on the cursor is not a great argument because, first of all, I think that, like, one of the cards, the cursor got killed at some point. And I've played a decent amount with and against cursor in Standard, and I hate that card. It's the worst card to be playing with because you've always got to be flipping over your deck. You feel obligated to track all the cards in your opponent's drawing, which in some levels is giving you enough information to plan better, but it's also overloading you with information that makes it harder for you to just execute your game plan and think clearly. And so, like, for me, I don't write down every card, but I keep notes of, oh, he has Hero's Downfall. I better deal with that before I play Ugin. Those sorts of things. And to even say that, like, it's your opponent's responsibility to know every card in your hand because there's been a cursor in play, that, you know, if your opponent, I think the opponent has room to be like, yeah, I do know what's in his hand, or just, regardless of the cursor, say, I know that it's that card because he set it down there and it's, you know, it's easy to flip over. And I think an opponent could let that go, but I think if you're playing at 5-0 on the Pro Tour, and maybe if you're about to lose game 3 of a very hard match, you're certainly not going to be too eager to cut your opponent some slack.
That's very true. And certainly his opponent has no reason to give Patrick any help in that situation. But I think, you know, the argument that he could, that Patrick continued to make was that even if his opponent and look, the rule here is clear that if your opponent can't prove it, then it's a game loss. So it is what it is. But Patrick's argument is that the video could prove that the selection was legal, and that the judge could have himself proven to himself that the selection was legal. But it's an interesting area because the rule is very clear that your opponent has to know that the selection was legal. And at that point, there's no reason for the opponent to make such a judgment, right?
Yeah, I mean, the opponent's the one person who isn't watching the video. You know,
exactly.
They don't have any idea, and it's awkward to put it on them.
And even if the judge can prove it, right, even if Patrick explains to the judge and the judge looks at his hand and says, oh, okay, his opponent still has no reason to believe the judge either.
Right.
Because then how do you know it's not, you know, a situation where the judge is, using their own discretion instead of following the rules as they're written. The rules are written for a reason.
Yeah. I mean, anytime, I think about this a bunch as a lawyer doing actual law, but you always have a judicial system or a means of judging that you have to draw some lines. And it does seem unfair to give someone a game loss in a situation where we know for a fact that everything he did was, other than not reveal the card, was proper. And if he had revealed it, it would have been fine. And, we have all of the evidence available to us to show that he wasn't cheating.
Right.
But we can't, it's not really fair to say, oh, well, because you're on camera and we can go back and prove it, that will allow you to do it in this situation. You end up just drawing these lines where you say, sometimes people get punished who are innocent or who aren't innocent but don't really deserve the punishment. And we generally make decisions that it's more fair to have a clearly understandable rule that, makes it less difficult for the judge and makes it, everyone can plan around it. And whenever you see those things on video, you feel a little uncomfortable sometimes. You say, he really didn't deserve to lose that game. And it seems like it's just a technicality. And the same thing comes up in the legal system where, for various reasons that I won't get into, things happen in court cases that you don't think are right, but it's because something wasn't available.
Right.
Maybe the best example or the worst example, depending on your opinion, is when, police get, information from criminal suspects in ways that the law doesn't allow. But
a lot of times
the courts will say, we got it. It's a little more complicated than that, but there are a lot of people who have gone to jail because the police did things they weren't supposed to do, but it didn't matter. And
the more on TV,
we're seeing the same thing now with all of the police violence and brutality in the Black Lives Matter campaign. And, all these people who are getting injured or killed by police, it's because there's video there that's showing it. That is really making it into a social media phenomenon, and people are talking about it, and hopefully things are starting to slowly change.
And so
that's why when Cedric Phillips wrote his article saying about the coverage that they really should not have shown the appeal of Patrick Chapin, I agree to a certain extent, and I wrote about this, but I also feel like having that sort of stuff out in the open generally isn't bad. Now, right. I would prefer not to have the commentators say bad things about the people during it, but,
that's definitely a separate issue, I think.
And so it's hard for me to feel too bad about that, about having a 5 or 10 minute judge interaction shown on TV or on the streaming coverage. And I don't think Patrick badly.
Yeah, I think it's a situation where I think there's value in understanding the judging process. And there's obviously value in understanding the whole front-to-back process, but the way it was presented, I think, is very unfortunate for everyone involved. And hopefully, look, it's a system that is always open for improvement, right? And I think, Helene Bergeau tweeted that, you know, something that insinuated that they're aware that video replay is a thing people would like to see. And obviously there's a lot of value in video replay, but there's also an incredible amount of problems, right, with using video replay today. It's not something they can just flip a switch and say, oh, look, now we have video replay.
I do have a solution for this.
Let me hear it.
Instead of having Pro Tours live in person, just do it on Modo. Modo is up to the task. We'll have a fail-safe rule system. We won't have to have any judges. And, yeah, it'll be great.
You're a funny guy.
Yeah,
you're a funny guy, Dave. If
we played all the Pro Tours on Magic Online, then everyone would play Kolaghan's Command, because apparently it's bugged and does, like, 4 damage now or something.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right. That would be amazing. No, I think we're well away from having the first Modo Pro Tour.
That just sounds miserable.
I was in the draft today, and I played this ridiculous finals match where my opponent had like every possible rare, and I was just like if it were a paper match, I would ask for a judge call to do a deck check. You know, it was unbelievable, and like I won game 2 and then almost won game 3 and felt like, geez, how do you win one of these things? I think I just ran into an incredibly powerful deck. But as soon as it ended, like, I got this message and it says, we have canceled this event and returned your prizes. And I don't I don't know if that's just an error message that popped up that wasn't supposed to pop up, and I still got like my 4 packs for coming in second. Didn't give that to me and gave me back my 3 packs and my 2 tickets that I bought in with. And it's almost impossible to verify unless you, like, before every match you play, you write down the exact number of packs and tickets and cards you have in your collection, which is
and wow.
The 64-player draft where there was, like, 8 extra players who weren't in the draft whose names appeared, you know, and it's, like, 72 players and only 64 of them are actually playing. And
wow, that's
bugs like that.
Yeah, obviously Modo's we could have a whole nother podcast about the problems with Magic Online. but that's a topic for another day. The issues with Pro Tour judges, it's something that I think we're just always gonna have to deal with. And it's a process that certainly needs improvement. And hopefully they'll make some improvements. What do you think, Dave, would be the best improvement they can make without putting the Pro Tour on Modo?
That's a hard question. I think.
Right? Yeah, is video replay the answer, or are there better things we can do than video replay?
I don't think video replay is the answer at all. I honestly think Magic coverage in terms of providing a video feed and commentary for the games is pretty good now. It isn't amazing by any stretch, but it does what it needs to do, and it conveys generally the information it needs to convey. There are improvements you can make, but whether or not they're worth it, like being able to visually identify each card on the table, for example, or visually identify each card in a hand and provide that to the viewer. You could do stuff like that, but that all requires a lot of technology and software, and
right.
We all see how well Wizards deals with that kind of stuff.
Right.
So
right.
I'm not sure any of it's really worth it.
Brendan, same question. What do you think the best thing they could do other than using Modo?
I don't know if there's a whole lot that, like, Wizards can do through the judges other than just, you know, having plenty of judges to be able to walk around and watch matches. I think something that we can do, or, you know, as a community, is just work on learning how to, you know, some of the psychological or interpersonal or empathetic elements of Magic playing. Being able to kind of read what your opponent's doing, understand, you know, being able to track the board state, you know, your opponent's emotions, how they handle their cards, how they move their deck, how you move your stuff around. Awareness of all of that sort of physical reality of playing, that if you practice that or you're good at it, you can generally have a good sense if someone's cheating. You can just notice if things are off. Like the ability to shuffle really well so that you can shuffle and watch your opponent shuffling
at right. the same
time. Maybe people need to, you know, if it feels like the deck is the wrong size, you know, get a feel for how big a 60-card deck feels. You know, sometimes that's hard because people double sleeve or they use different thickness sleeves.
Right.
You know, if the deck feels
well, this like is all, but this is all stuff. These are all great things, but these are all things. How do you identify someone who's cheating? Right. How what's the solution where we can actually prevent people from cheating in the first place? Is there? I mean, that's a pretty big question. Like, I don't even know if there is a great way. We talked before about, you know, the fact that bannings and suspensions are the big tool that the DCI has. Is that kind of the bottom line? Is we're just gonna have to keep banning and suspending people and hoping that people stop cheating, and in the meantime we just have to train people how to spot cheaters?
I think for the most part, probably. I mean, we could, you know, was it that movie Minority Report where they would go right. and get records of what people were doing in the future? You know, there's only so much we can do. I mean, they could do technological things like scanning in each person's deck, like sort of like they do in sports now where they have chips inside the balls or like on the player's uniform so they can track their movements. You know, right. we're obviously, there's nowhere near enough money involved in Magic to make that worth doing. But the problem is the more Magic is getting more lucrative, I don't know how much more, but you know, you can make some amount of money playing Magic. And the more money you can make, if the game grows and if there develops more money in the competitions, then there's going to be more people seeing value in cheating because they're like, all I got to do is win one, not get caught, and I get $50,000 or something.
Right.
They start having larger and larger purses. And so I think it's just something we're going to have to deal with, being able to, you know, publicly call out cheating, not accepted, not rationalized for people who get caught. Try to make it as both as welcoming to people and as unwelcoming to cheaters as we can. It's sort of
right.
not much else we can do, I don't think.
So maybe the trick then is really just to improve the ways we can detect cheating and make sure that we do get to apply suspensions and bans when necessary. Because I think that might actually be one of the biggest problems today is that people genuinely believe they can get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, that was pretty true. But with improved video coverage, and I'm not talking about replay during matches, but investigations post-match, more people are getting caught after the fact than ever before. And that should lead to more people getting banned and suspended because of it. And hopefully that'll be the proper deterrent. Because I think the deterrent has always been there. People don't want to get banned or suspended, but they've never had the actual threat of being caught as consistently as they do today. So, cool. Well, we're just about out of time. So final question to you guys, Pro Tour Dragons of Tarkir is now over. The next Pro Tour in 3 months will be Pro Tour Origins. What would you like to see most, improved or changed, in the coverage or the environment or the, whatever it is you'd like to see different or better at the next Pro Tour, Brendan, what would it be?
I want them to just get better at managing moving between the four feature matches. I think they've gotten a lot better at it. But like the Chapin argument incident, I mean, I think that was at the end of the round where there weren't any more matches to go to. But they should basically be following all four. And if one game is really interesting, you can move around or just line it up so that everything is really smooth. And then, you know, potentially, like they've done on some of the GPs, record one of them and then play it back later during breaks so you can just get more and more coverage of what's going on, at least if there's, you know, they see a game that looks really worth showing. And I think there's plenty of room for them to improve in that area.
Makes sense. Dave, same question?
You know, I was thinking during this last GP, or GP, this last Pro Tour, that being able to broadcast each individual match in the feature area or in the a feature match area.
Yeah.
Would be a fascinating experiment. Most of you probably don't know this, but NBC has had the rights to the English Premier League, the soccer league in
It's England. Great. They show it on every freaking channel
they show every match of the weekend on every single channel NBC has access to.
Yep.
And what that allows for is it allows you basically to choose any match you want. But it means that you're not tied to the match that they choose to show on the main NBC channel. And I know it might be stretching the on-air talent that Wizards has currently. But honestly, if you have people like Ian Duke in your employment, use them. Give them the ability to do the B, C, or D match.
Right.
And I mean, hell, if LSV doesn't make day two, put him on the B match the entire day. You know, don't let the guy sit around and twiddle his thumbs.
If he doesn't make day two.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't this time. That's what I'm saying. You know, I mean, you can't 0-5 and not give me commentary on day two, all right? That's what I'm saying.
He's going to eat some Belgian fries, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think this, as the feature match area expands and as the coverage technology improves, I think it's inevitable that we're going to start to see more of the feature matches available. You know, it's what did they had recently? They've been doing the preview drafts, right? They do the preview drafts on Magic Online. And when they do those, you have access to several of the Twitch channels, right?
Yeah. All eight are invited based on their streaming status.
So that's a scenario where, you know, we've got multiple streams. And obviously the on-air talent isn't being stretched too thin there. But it's clearly an improvement for sure.
Yeah, I mean, if you could take the one draft pod at the beginning of the Pro Tour and put every single match be able to watch that entire draft and put every single match from that draft in the feature area and broadcast every single match from that pod, I think that'd be a fascinating experiment. I'm not gonna promise that it's going to be better than what they currently do, but I think it would be a fascinating experience.
No, I think it would be a great experience. I think people would really want to see that happen. So, yeah. Sorry, I was rocket launching someone. kind of lost my train of thought there. Anyways, so that's all we got. And hopefully you guys enjoyed it. And I'm going to have to call a judge over to help me turn this thing off.
Hey Guardians, thanks for tuning in to the Doom Travelers podcast. You can find more at doomtravelers.com or follow at Doom Travelers on Twitter for show updates and other nonsense. Make sure to subscribe to Hipsters TV on YouTube for videos of our previous episodes, and don't forget that you can find audio-only versions of the Doom Travelers podcast on iTunes. For your host Rich Stein and Matt the Obliterator Jones, I'm David Bones McCoy. See you next time.